From Swarthmore College.
From Swarthmore College,
this is...
This is...
This is...
This is War News Radio.
I'm Caroline Batten.
And I'm Patty Gutierrez.
This week on War News Radio, unintended consequences. We learn about Afghanistan's National Solidarity Program.
So the important step for the sustainability of, let's say, the development process is, in fact, the Afghan ownership in their capacity building. And that's why, in order to have a sustainable change in the rural as well as urban communities of Afghanistan, we need to develop the capacities of Afghans.
Then, we hear about the effects of the revolution in Egypt on its relationship with Israel.
Someone climbed the 22 floors, just imagine it, to remove the Israeli flag with the shouting of people around him. But it's not. This is not the end of the problem. The real problem is when you see this person is treated as hero on the Egyptian media. That is the real core of the problem. When you see there is no punishment for this person by the government for doing the crime of attacking a foreign embassy, that is the core of the problem.
But first, a roundup of this week's news.
Insurgents armed with suicide vests, rocket-propelled grenades, and heavy machine guns attacked the U.S. Embassy and NATO headquarters in Kabul, killing at least 16 people. The siege lasted almost 20 hours and was fought mainly between the insurgents and Afghan forces, though U.S. helicopters assisted in the counterattack. The United States is blaming the strike on the Pakistani-based Haqqani Militant Network, a key ally of al-Qaeda. As U.S. and NATO forces prepare for the scheduled withdrawal of most of their troops by 2014, the apparent ease with which the insurgents seize control of central Kabul is raising serious concerns about the Afghan military's ability to defend the capital city.
A United Nations report released this week accuses the government of Yemen of using lethal violence against protesters. In June, a team from the Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights conducted an on-the-ground assessment in Yemen's three largest cities, returning with thousands of photographs, documents, and videos from the protests. According to the report, the military has used excessive and disproportionate lethal force against the protesters, resulting in hundreds dead and thousands wounded. Yemeni demonstrators initially gathered to call for the ousting of President Ali Abdullah Saleh, who is currently out of the country recovering from injuries from a bomb blast on his palace in June. Since then, protesters have been demanding greater freedom and an end to government corruption. The UN report also denounced the Yemeni government for cutting off civilians' electricity, fuel, and water supplies in their attempt to silence the protesters. Overall, the report advocates for an independent assessment of the situation and immediate international action for the growing humanitarian crisis.
In a statement released to Yemen's official news agency, President Ali Abdullah Saleh granted authority to his vice president to begin negotiations transferring government power to opposition groups. According to the decree, Yemen's vice president, Abed al-Rahman Mansour al-Hadi, now has the constitutional authority to sign a proposal that would lead to presidential elections and a peaceful transition of power. However, the formal opposition, known as the Joint Meeting Parties, has rejected the decree, demanding that Saleh step aside without any further dialogue.
A general from Egypt's Supreme Council of the Armed Forces says the military will issue a decree expanding the state of emergency in the country. General Mamdouh Shahin says the emergency law will be amended to include activities which disrupt traffic, including demonstrations, and spread false rumors, potentially incriminating journalists. Critics fear that this change in policy, seen as a response to a recent clash between police and protesters storming the Israeli embassy in Cairo, may open the door to other human rights abuses. The council had promised to lift emergency law in time for parliamentary elections, but politicians have speculated that elections may be delayed because of the new measures.
Egyptian security forces raided the offices of Al Jazeera affiliate TV station Mubashir Mizr, or Al Jazeera Live Egypt, confiscating equipment and detaining some staff. The station was founded to cover the Egyptian protests, and officials say it was targeted for operating without a license. Al Jazeera Live Egypt claims that it applied for a license but received no response. Previously, the government issued a warning that it would shut down any news outlet that endangers the stability and security of Egypt. The new government is on edge after a mob attacked the Israeli embassy.
Four separate attacks aimed at security forces across Iraq have claimed at least 19 lives. The deadliest of the attacks resulted when a car bomb exploded outside a restaurant frequented by security officials near the southern town of Al-Shumali, killing 11. A drive-by shooting at a security checkpoint killed two police officers and injured a third. Also this week, 22 Shiite pilgrims were found dead in Iraq's Anbar province. They were apparently traveling to visit a shrine in Syria when they were stopped by gunmen at a remote checkpoint. The gunmen then forced the women off the bus before killing the men.
3 weeks after Libyan opposition forces took control of Tripoli, former leader Muammar Gaddafi is still on the run. While new leaders attempt to revive political and economic structures frozen by the revolution, loyalist forces remain in control of Sirte, Bani Walid, Jufra, and Sabah. Mustafa Abdul Jalil, leader of Libya's National Transitional Council, says Gaddafi is planning further attacks on the new government from southern Libya, and statements from Gaddafi continue to denounce intervening international forces as terrorists. His inner circle reportedly took large amounts of gold and cash with them as they escaped south into Niger, where Gaddafi's son, Saadi, is currently being housed in the Nigerian presidential villa. U.S. envoy Jeffrey Feltman pledged full United States support for the National Transitional Council this week.
Mustafa Abdul Jalil, the leader of the Libyan National Transitional Council, addressed Libyans for the first time in Martyrs Square, in the largest public appearance of revolutionary leaders since rebels took control of the Libyan capital. In his speech, Abdul Jalil called for unity between Libyans and urged support for a new government based on the rule of law. A day after Abdul Jalil's speech, Amnesty International released a new report claiming that both pro-Qaddafi and anti-Qaddafi forces committed human rights abuses over the course of the war. In response, the NTC released a statement condemning any abuse committed by either side and pledged to uphold the rule of law.
International rights groups are calling on the Arab League to fully suspend Syria's membership in the organization until the government ends its violent crackdown on dissenters. Although the Arab League has already demanded that the Syria government stop violence against protesters, the government began fresh raids on at least 10 villages in the northwestern Idlib province this week. Activists report that security forces opened fire in the area with machine guns, blocked roads, and cut off local communication.
Iranian President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad made public plans to release two American hikers who have been imprisoned in the country for 2 years on charges of espionage. According to reports, the hikers accidentally crossed over the Iraq-Iran border while hiking in the Kurdish region of Iraq. Just weeks before his annual trip to the United Nations General Assembly in New York, Ahmadinejad stated that he intended to pardon and release both hikers in the near future. However, Iran's courts rejected these plans, claiming that Ahmadinejad lacked the authority to pardon the hikers. This denial seems to signal a growing rift between Ahmadinejad and the conservative factions within Iran, especially Iran's supreme commander, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei. As of now, the time of the hikers' release is still unknown. This is War News Radio. Foreign assistance currently supports all aspects of Afghan public service, from the police force to road infrastructure to farming. Unintended consequences often limit the effectiveness of these programs, but there is an alternative to the standard development model, which results in waste, corruption, and conflict. In the first segment of this series documenting the economy of Afghanistan and the measures required to sustain the Afghan state, War News Radio's Jared Nolan examined the administration of foreign aid in Afghanistan and concluded that in many cases, the aid does just as much harm as good. In this part, Nolan focuses on a program practicing small-scale development at the community level.
You may never have heard of it, but the National Solidarity Program is the most successful development initiative in Afghanistan. And it's not new. The project started back in 2003. Since then, it has received over $1.5 billion in funding from international donors and reached all 34 of Afghanistan's provinces and 25,000 communities countrywide. All told, the program has directly affected over 18 million Afghans out of the country's population of 29 million. So what sets this program apart?
I think the main reason for the success of this program is the design of this program, because compared to so many other development interventions in the country, NSP is totally different.
That's Tariq Ismadi, the executive director of the National Solidarity Program. He's referring to the alternative approach to development supported by Dr. David Kilcullen in the last segment of this series. Kilcullen founded Caris Associates, a consulting firm based in Washington that has counseled NATO in Afghanistan.
The sorts of development assistance that tend to do better in a place like Afghanistan are things that focus on the village level or the district level, that focus on the improvement of traditional agriculture, basic infrastructure, energy, particularly electricity access at the village level, and then things that have to do with institutionalizing government.
But how does that work in practice? For the NSP, it involves a two-year process where communities apply for block grants dispersed by the Afghan government. In the first step, NGOs, what the program refers to as facilitating partners, reach out to the individual villages to establish elections for community development councils, or CDCs. Once elected, the CDC works with a facilitating partner and identifies a project to serve community needs and then applies for a grant. When the money arrives, the CDC organizes its development.
And the projects implemented are those which a common person needs.
Ayub Khan is the provincial accountant for the Paktika Province Division of the NSP.
Paktika is located in a mountainous region. Here in most of the area, underground drinking water is not available for the people. And bringing water from one area to another is also difficult due to lack of transportation facilities. So people request for hand pump projects. And the most common type of projects in the provinces are hand pumps, solars, protection wall, car risk cleaning, and human capital development projects.
So these councils get money from the government to implement basic projects in their communities. About a quarter of the block grants go to transportation infrastructure, another quarter to improving water supply, and the rest is split between irrigation, education, and power. That's all there is to it. But behind this simple design are untold advantages. The average value of the block grant that each community receives is $33,000 and maxes out at $60,000. According to Kilcullen, the limited amount of cash that can be allocated to any specific project has a number of positive effects.
One is it doesn't create a big target for, you know, corrupt actors to come and try and win over a piece of that project.
Part of the project costs also come from the community members themselves. The village is required to contribute at least 10% of these costs, either in cash, labor, or in kind. On average, the communities provide 17%. This stipulation ensures buy-in from the community. They have a stake in the success of the initiative. So more often than not, the projects proceed as planned. But that's not even the most important thing.
Even though the project might be something to do with water or electricity, the project is actually the community, not the thing itself.
Before this program, there was no institution at the local level managed by Afghans to organize development projects. Ayub Khan says the community development councils have even exceeded their mandate.
Our CDC is the base for local governance in the villages. They act as a bridge between the people and the government. Now CDCs can share their problems and their necessities with the government and NGOs at provincial and district levels. They are able to resolve their conflicts within the communities by arranging a meeting in the presence of the Mullah Imam and the elder people.
The CDCs have fulfilled the role of interim village councils and will continue to do so until formal elections can take place in the coming years. Ismadi explains what this means for development in rural areas.
So the important step for the sustainability of, let's say, the development process is, in fact, Afghan ownership in their capacity building. And that's why, in order to have a sustainable change in the rural as well as urban communities of Afghanistan, we need to develop the capacities of Afghans, so that in the future they can continue to work with those development processes, and particularly the local institutions at the village level.
So in order to ensure that development in Afghanistan continues, Afghans must be able to organize it themselves, and that is what this program accomplishes. Benefits are not just at the local level either. The improvement in governance extends to federal institutions. The NSP is administered by the Ministry of Rural Rehabilitation and Development, or MRRD, one of the few Afghan ministries that has the proven ability to handle a large amount of development funds. One of the main reasons behind this capacity is the amount of competent Afghans the program can retain at all levels. The NSP has resisted brain drain because it can offer salaries comparable to the traditionally better-paying NGOs and contractors. Ayub Khan says the NSP pays more than a regular government job, and if he couldn't find a position at NSP, he would certainly work for an NGO. Ismadi's story is similar. For 12 years, he worked in Afghanistan for NGOs and the United Nations on development and humanitarian projects.
So, and then I became part of MRRD since 5 years. So I proved to be able leading different important programs in this ministry. And as a result of that, through a competition process, I was, let's say, selected as the qualified candidate. And since 2 years, started as the executive director.
Their career paths underlie an important trend. At its inception, the NSP's management consisted solely of internationals. Now the only non-Afghan is in the finance department. This is what the experts mean when they say capacity building, Afghans having the ability to carry out development in their own country. The NSP is now entering its third phase, and the focus is on reaching the remaining 30% of communities. The program also plans to deliver a second round of block grants to a number of past recipients. The present concern, however, is that the remaining areas are the least secure in the country, and effectiveness of the program will drop since the facilitating partners cannot provide the same oversight to these communities. Ismadi has a response.
It's definitely a concern that insecurity affect our program sometimes. But what is important that the program has been led and implemented by the local communities in the past 7 years, which we also had some areas that were insecure, but the people were quite able to support and defend the program. So given that strong commitment that we have for this program, that encourages us that despite problems, we might be able to deliver the program in those remaining areas.
Development can succeed when the villagers are invested. In fact, there are reported cases of community members defending their local projects from the Taliban, and as a result, the Taliban are less likely to attack them. The program takes small steps by implementing very small projects to ensure that they reach completion and actually contribute to relieving poverty. It will never organize big development projects like highways or railroads, but it's large scale in the sense that it has improved the lives of so many people across Afghanistan. Overall, this program strikes a crucial balance between ensuring aid money is spent wisely and making a major impact. Next time in the series on the Afghan economy and the search for a sustainable state, my colleague Alan Zhao will explore the complexity of illicit opium cultivation. For War News Radio, I'm Jared Nolan.
This is War News Radio. The fall of Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak in February, like much of the turmoil in the region, was unexpected. The collapse of his regime has added to the complexity of diplomatic relations in the Middle East. Egypt was the first Arab state to make peace with Israel, but some of the voices of the revolution are calling for Egypt to reconsider that relationship. Sam Hirschman has more on the shifting ties between the two countries.
During a protest in late August, Egyptian demonstrator Ahmed al-Shahat scaled the wall of the Israeli embassy in Cairo. Climbing to the top, he tore down the flag of Israel and replaced it with an Egyptian flag. He became an instant Egyptian hero. Dr. Taufik Hamid, a senior fellow and chair for the study of Islamic radicalism at the Potomac Institute for Policy Studies in Arlington, Virginia, believes that Egypt's response to the flagman hints at the larger issues between the neighboring countries.
Someone climbed the 22 floors, just imagine it, to remove the Israeli flag with the shouting of people around him. But this is not the end of the problem. The real problem is when you see this person is treated as hero on the Egyptian media. That is the real core of the problem. When you see there is no punishment for this person by the government for doing the crime of attacking a foreign embassy, that is the core of the problem.
Since the fall of former Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak's regime in February, the previously stable relationship between Israel and Egypt has been cast into doubt. The peace treaty signed by Egyptian President Anwar Sadat and Israeli Prime Minister Menachem Begin in 1979, which normalized relations between the two countries, is being criticized in the Egyptian media and in the streets. On September 10th, Egyptian protesters stormed the Israeli embassy in Cairo, forcing the Israeli ambassador and his staff to leave the country. A Pew Research Center poll from April found that 54% of Egyptians believe that Egypt should annul its treaty with Israel. Dr. Eli Carmon, a senior research scholar at the Institute for Counterterrorism at the Interdisciplinary Center in Herzliya, Israel, fears the consequences of canceling the treaty.
This will bring our two countries, but the region as a whole, I think, on the brink of a very, very difficult situation, a very dangerous situation.
What would canceling the treaty entail? Dr. Hamid doesn't think the people in the Egyptian streets really know the answer. The treaty contains two parts, normalization of the relationship between the two nations, and the peaceful return of the Sinai Peninsula to Egypt, which had been annexed by Israel in 1967. Dr. Hamid says if Egypt cancels the treaty, they will have to return the Sinai and will lose American aid.
The Egyptians can continuously ask for and ending the peace treaty and blame the military council and their leaders for trying to keep the treaty because they have not faced the reality. Sometimes you need people to face the reality of and the consequences of their decisions.
But Dr. Abdel Monem Said Ali, president of Al Ahram Center for Political and Strategic Studies in Cairo, thinks the danger to the peace is overstated.
After all, the Egyptian state's strong. I mean, it's not. We have the state, and one what distinguished the revolution in Egypt, that the state continued. It did not melt. You have the army, and with the same person that was there before the revolution. And you have the judiciary, and there is the Egyptian bureaucracy who made peace with Israel in the past and made a lot of agreements with them. So it's not only the street that's governing Egyptian policy.
Dr. Ali admits the peace between the two nations was not particularly warm before the fall of Mubarak, but it was effective.
It was a kind of, you know, uneasy relationship, but still going in a cordial way. Whenever there was a clear and persistent kind of a common interest in any topic, both countries went through it and achieved it.
Because the peace under Mubarak was mostly pragmatic and did not encourage good relations between the Israeli and Egyptian peoples, Dr. Hamid blames the current troubles between Israel and Egypt not on the revolution, but on Mubarak himself.
So I see it's getting worse, it's no doubt about this. But I'm not seeing it as a product of the revolution. I'm seeing it as just unmasking of what Mubarak regime was doing over 30 years, of pretending that he's a friend of Israel, yet promoting or allowing the promotion of the most anti-Semitic views and ideology within the country. So it was very schizophrenic situation. On one hand, the Mubarak pretends that he has good relations with the Israelis, and some of them were happy with this. But at the same time, he was allowing a very lethal form and destructive form of anti-Semitism.
All in all, Dr. Ali believes it is still too early to tell what will happen in Egypt's relationship with Israel.
Any final judgment here, it will be premature. We got to wait until the elections and how the constitutional group will be formed and the new cabinet, and then we can have a much more educated, understanding of what's happening.
It is clear, however, that Israel's position in the region is becoming increasingly precarious. Dr. Carmon says that peace with Egypt is central to Israeli security.
From the point of view of Israel, Egypt is probably the most important strategic asset. The peace with Egypt, but at the same time, it's the most important strategic threat. It is the biggest Arab country with more than 80 million people, the biggest army, and by the way, the modern army, which was armed by the United States.
Further, Israel's ties to other Arab nations are crumbling. Threats of protest in Jordan led the Israeli embassy there to withdraw most of its staff from the country. Turkey has expelled Israel's ambassador, and, in addition, the Palestinian Authority is increasing pressure for a UN vote to recognize a Palestinian state. From the looks of it, the chaos of the recent Arab revolutions is continuing to reshape the image of the modern Middle East. For War News Radio, I'm Sam Hirschman.
That's our show for this week.
War News Radio is a production of Swarthmore College.
Visit us online to listen to archived shows, learn more about the program, or subscribe to our podcast. That's at warnewsradio.org.
You can follow us on Twitter and Facebook to keep up with War News Radio between shows. Look for the links on our site.
Our behind-the-scenes crew this week includes Eliana Biscard Church, Kyle Crawford, Axel Kodat, Rosanna Kim, Amandine Lee, Max Nesterak, Stuart Russell, Colin Smith, Christine Song, Chloe Wittenberg, and Alan Zhao. Our producer is Jim McMillan. I'm Caroline Batten.
And I'm Patty Gutierrez. Until next time, thanks for listening.